Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So today, the title of my talk is Four Kinds of Meditation. So many of you know that over the course of the last, I don't know how long, I have a poor memory, so a year, maybe more, I started thinking differently about our classic form of Soto Zen meditation, Shikantaza, and really embracing it wholeheartedly as a method of no method, and highly recommending it as a complete practice, not as a, you know, first you calm your mind and then you embrace Shikantaza kind of thing. But over the course of the last year, in interacting with people here and interacting with people in my who listen to my podcast, and we have podcast discussions and stuff like that, it became clear to me that somehow I had given the impression that I thought like real Zen students would only do Shikantaza, and that there wasn't really a place for these other kinds of practices in our practice.
One question. Can you just explain for people that don't know what is actually Shikantaza?
Well, I will get to that, because that will be the fourth kind of meditation. But Shikantaza is just sitting. Thank you for. So it's the just sitting meditation that I will train somebody to do if they come for an intro to meditation. It's just sitting still and upright and not trying to control your meditative experience and yet attend to everything that happens. So I will go more into what that form of meditation is like. So the message that I want to get across is that all meditation is great. And there's a place for all of it. And really, a lot of the things that... some of the things, at least, that these other forms of meditation do, typically in Soto Zen, we just figure you're doing that off the cushion. We figure you're practicing mindfulness as you go about your daily life, and you're working with precepts, and you're reflecting on your behavior, and all these kinds of things. But I'm also beginning to appreciate that in a busy lay life, that it's beneficial to spend some of your meditation time cultivating these activities, which I'll get to. But first I want to just, I wrote an idiot's guide on meditation. So I wrote like 350 pages or something on meditation. This covers 9 different kinds, like a chapter on each of 9 different kinds of meditation. And then it covers additional ones as well. And so I really took the time to explain, what is meditation? I mean, there's lots of different forms of it. You know, some of it is silent, some of it's not. Like, what ties it all together? So one of the things that I really keep in mind, this book, The Relaxation Response, that some people may recognize, it was like a total bestseller in like the 70s, I think. Yeah, original 1975 copyright. So this researcher... He first started studying TM meditators because TM was really claiming, you know, it had all these beneficial effects. And when they studied it, he found there were beneficial effects, but he was like, you know, is it really limited to TM? Do you really have to sign up for their program and get a mantra? Or, you know, are there other forms of meditation that do similar things? So what he says here is our studies... revealed, so he talks about as many of you are aware, we have this stress response when we feel threatened or in danger. When faced with stressful situations, our bodies release hormones, adrenaline and noradrenaline, or epinephrine and norepinephrine, to increase heart rate, breathing rate, blood pressure, metabolic rate, and blood flow to the muscles, gearing our bodies either to do battle with an opponent or to flee. So our studies revealed that the opposite was also true. The body is also imbued with what I termed the relaxation response, an inducible physiological state of quietude. Indeed, our progenitors handed down to us a second, equally essential survival mechanism, the ability to heal and rejuvenate our bodies. In modern times, the relaxation response is undoubtedly even more important to our survival, since anxiety and tension often inappropriately trigger the fight or flight response in us. Regular elicitation of the relaxation response can prevent and compensate for the damage incurred by frequent nervous reactions that pulse through our hearts and bodies. And so when the mind is focused, whether through meditation or other repetitive mental activities, the body responds with a dramatic decrease in heart rate, breathing rate, blood pressure, if it was elevated to begin with, and metabolic rate, the exact opposite effects of the flight or fight response. And so then he tried to limit it down, like what are the essential components of a meditative activity, or whatever you want to call it, a meditation. So originally they thought a quiet environment, a mental device, a sound, word, phrase, or prayer repeated silently or out loud, or a fixed gaze at an object, some kind of meditative object. A passive attitude, not worrying about how well one is performing the technique, and simply putting aside distracting thoughts to return to one's focus. And then they thought a comfortable position, but then they actually found the quiet environment and the comfortable position don't have to be part of it. So all we need is a mental device, or a kind of a meditative object, and a passive attitude. So we're just focusing on that meditative object and not really trying to gain anything out of it. And that's it. And so they actually think that perhaps this started to evolve once human beings were, you know, gathering in bands and discovered fire. And so we'd gather around the fire at night, and we were safe because we were in a group, and we had fire to, like, you know, ward off wild animals. And so we were able to just kind of relax and just look into the fire, and this kind of meditative thing happened. So, this relaxation response has to be something that we deliberately invoke, or, you know, in this particular circumstance. It's not something that just happens when you're just chilling out, reading a book, or, you know, it might, but if you think about it, if you're listening to music or something, you can do any of those things meditatively. You know, if you were listening to music and you were really bringing your awareness back to the music continually, then it would have this meditative effect. But just kind of listening to it, you know, for just pleasure and letting your mind wander, wouldn't be the same. So I defined meditation for this book. It involves a conscious direction of your mind for a period of time in order to affect the mind itself. So it's really something that we do to affect the mind and body themselves. And it's not for some other purpose. So the nature of meditative objects, what makes meditation effective is how or where you choose to direct your mind while you're doing it. Meditative objects or techniques are never productive or useful in and of themselves. Something beneficial may arise from the whole process, but you aren't achieving anything tangible by directing your mind toward your breathing, God, the space between which thoughts arise, a word you silently repeat, a slow stretch in a yoga pose, or a visualization. You aren't getting any work done, you aren't figuring anything out, at least in your usual way, and you won't have anything to show for your meditation afterward, except perhaps subtle differences in your behavior or health because of how meditation has affected your mind. So then, there's many different kinds of meditation, and today I'm going to parse them out into four different kinds. Next year I might think there's five. I don't know. Kyogen used to say, one of our teachers, that the Dharma's like a tomato. There's many different ways to slice and prepare the tomato. You know, you can go like this, or you can dice it up. You can, you know, peel it and seed it. And there's not like there's one that's right, and they don't necessarily correspond directly to each other. But today we're going to slice it into four kinds of meditation. And there's overlap and there's similarities. And so if you find yourself going, yeah, but how is that different from, you know, that's kind of the nature of it. This is a whole body and mind experience activity that we do. So it's not something that's really easily parsed out. But I think it's helpful to think about these different kinds of meditation and maybe even be clear with yourself about what you're doing in any given moment. So the four kinds, as I see it right now, are calming meditation, for calming the mind and body, cultivating, that's cultivating positive states of mind or qualities, investigating, so this is what a lot of people might call insight meditation or Vipassana, where you're investigating aspects of experience or Dharma for the purpose of insight. And then letting go, the kind of themeless, objectless type of meditation like Shikantaza. And I also think there's a lot of, there's not a lot of forms of meditation like that, but I think Dzogchen meditation is pretty similar. Vajrayana often has an initial kind of shine, kind of open awareness meditation. And if you're wondering where mindfulness fits in all of this, because in the modern mindfulness movement, you talk about mindfulness meditation, but traditionally in Buddhism, mindfulness is a faculty of mind. It's remembering. It's coming. It's remembering and coming back. So that faculty is employed in all kinds of meditation. It's like remembering, presence. All right, so first of all, calming. So I was going to briefly describe each of these kinds of meditation and what they're for, and then do a brief guided meditation. We, like, do not usually do guided meditations in Zen, but sometimes I wonder if we should more often, because I think what people appreciate about them is it kind of shows what a particular way to use the mind or direct the attention might feel like. So in calming meditation, this is really the simplest kind, where you have a meditative object of your breath or the ambient sounds in your environment. Ideally not like distracting sounds like conversations or something, but just kind of ambient sounds. Your body can be a focus of this, whether you're doing a directed body scan or just thinking of your kind of position. Not in Zen, but typically other forms of meditation, there might be a syllable or a mantra that you are repeating. There's forms of meditation where there's a visualization that you are doing, or you might actually look at some actual image, or even kind of that more of an open awareness of the present moment. So then you notice when your mind has wandered, and then you just, you know, return your attention to the meditative object. Ideally with the absolute minimum of judgment. You know, it's just a patient returning over and over. And, you know, this kind of meditation has been shown to be successful in the interruption of compulsive thoughts and emotions. You know, sometimes we're really perseverating on things and just, you know, kind of we're interrupting that over and over again to just bring our awareness back to something very simple. And usually over time, people find that this kind of meditation, especially if you have, you know, emotional issues going on in your life or something, there's a way that because you end up kind of interrupting and releasing that, your obsession with it, it kind of changes your relationship to it. You feel a little bit more of a sense of space around those thoughts and feelings. So there's a, you know, there's a little bit more of a freedom around when these things arise that are not immediately completely fully taking us over and we're believing them entirely. It's like, oh, and more of a sense, oh, that thought is arising, that emotion is arising, that experience. And also, you know, even if you don't have something kind of big going on, most of us, when we're not otherwise occupied with activities or concerns or being entertained, we just are basically our default mode starts to operate, which I think of this as like, you remember those, you used to be able to let your computer work on like scanning signals from space to look for aliens. You could just, when your computer wasn't busy, it could just be working on that in the background. And it's kind of like our, you know, if our brains are like a computer, it's like, well, you know, there's nothing going on right now, so we'll just start, you know, analyzing that past experience and, you know, imagining what's going to happen next week and rehearsing it and, you know, all kinds of processing that we're doing whenever we're not busily engaged. And I mean, to some extent, you know, I think that's probably natural, and sometimes it helps the creative process and whatever, but a lot of times, you know, if you really examine the content of that thinking, it's just, you know, I mean, how many times have you rehearsed an interaction you're going to have with somebody and had it actually go that way? You know, not very often. So a lot of times this just, and it actually can, you know, just kind of maybe even trigger some of that stress that Benson was talking about. So being able to at least recognize what is going on in our own minds and make a choice about where we want to put our attention is what this kind of meditation can help with. So I'm going to lead you through a very short little body scan. And you can close your eyes if you want. You don't have to. And this, yeah, just go for it. So starting at the top of your head and ending at your toes, the main point of this meditation is to simply practice being aware. It doesn't matter how technically you follow these instructions, as long as you use your meditation time to just let go of using your mind's narrative network, your comments and stories about what is going on, and instead use your mind's experiential network. Whenever you find your mind wandering, gently and non-judgmentally bring your awareness back to your present experience. It doesn't matter if you have to do this dozens of times during this meditation, as long as you always bring yourself back to the present. So become aware of the very top of your head and allow your awareness to rest there. Notice any tension you might be holding in this area. Relax this area more and more deeply. In a sense, there's always a little bit of tension, so the process of relaxation can continue indefinitely. Once the top of your head feels relaxed, imagine a sense of warmth filling in. Now move your awareness down to your face. Check for tension in the forehead, eyes, cheeks, mouth, jaw, there's any tension, just first notice it, and then let it go if you can. If it doesn't release, just invite it to melt. Imagine your face, the sense of warmth filling it. Now move your awareness down to your neck and chest. Notice any tension. Invite any tension to melt away. Imagine your neck and chest feel warm. Move your awareness to your abdomen and pelvic area. Notice any tension. Invite any tension to melt away. Feel warmth in your abdomen. Move your awareness to your legs and feet. Any tension there? See what it feels like to release that tension. Feel the warmth extending down to your feet. And move awareness to your toes. Notice any tension in your toes. And invite any tension from the whole body to flow out to the tips of your toes. So I know many people will, they have a period of meditation that they are, you know, a time period of time they're designating for meditation will start with some kind of calming meditation, even if it's just to follow the breath for a while or count. Sometimes people count the breaths, you know, 1 to 10, just kind of a, for many of us, it's just it's an interruption of that habit energy of, you know, thinking and worrying and planning and perseverating and all that stuff that we're caught in usually in our daily life. And, you know, and unless we kind of interrupt that, sometimes we sit down and just continue to do that as we meditate. So then the second kind of meditation that I'm talking about is cultivating. So, you know, we can, not just through our experience we know this, but actually research is showing we can actually rewire our brains with meditation. So not only do we notice our experience is different, but apparently you can actually, you know, change the strengths of connections in different parts of your brain. So, as I mentioned before, over time, there tends to be a less identification with troubling emotions and thoughts. There's a certain kind of, not a disassociation, but a certain kind of space around it. Less stuck in perseverating. But then we can also really choose positive, beneficial qualities or states of mind that we want to cultivate. So examples of this is, of course, loving kindness or metta meditation, which we will briefly do. There's cultivating gratitude, calling to mind, you know, all the aspects of your life for which you are grateful. I'm not very familiar with this, but I did cover this form of meditation in this book of a Vajrayana visualization of the Bodhisattva of compassion, Chenrezig, who, you know, there's a elaborate visualization, and you work on this visualization and feel the sense of the Bodhisattva radiating compassion. And then there's a, once you have that, there's different stages, but then there's a point where, like, you and the Bodhisattva become one. So there's kind of this deliberate, positive working on something which ends up being transformative. Another one that I thought of was the contemplation, the five contemplations. So kind of keeping in mind impermanence, mortality, karma, and using that to motivate your practice. So those are, the first one, I am sure to become old, I cannot avoid aging. And so sometimes these are just, you know, they might be recited silently or out loud. I am sure to become ill, I cannot avoid illness. I am sure to die, I cannot avoid death. I must be separated and departed from all that is dear and beloved to me. And I am owner of my actions, heir of my actions. Actions are the womb from which I am sprung. Actions are my relations, actions are my protection. Whatever actions I do, good or bad, of these I shall become the heir. So it's a way to cultivate a certain attitude toward your practice. So let's very briefly do a loving kindness meditation. So take a few moments to call to mind someone for whom you easily feel unconditional love. This may be a child, it may be a pet, a respected teacher, someone for whom you feel gratitude, very positive and uncomplicated relationship. Now, keeping that being in mind, say to yourself silently, may you be free from fear and anxiety. And try to feel that sincerely, to wish that for that being. May you be free from fear and anxiety. May you be at ease. May you be happy. May you be free from fear and anxiety. May you be at ease. May you be happy. Now, keeping that warm, open, unconditional sense of goodwill, call to mind someone important in your life, a spouse or a friend, thing. May you be free from fear and anxiety. May you be at ease. May you be happy. Trying to keep that open sense of goodwill. and extending it. Try extending it to yourself. And try to make it unconditional. May I be free from fear and anxiety. May I be at ease. May I be happy. Setting aside all of the reasons you might withhold that kind of warmth and goodwill to yourself. Because extending metta is healing from inside and out. May I be free from fear and anxiety. May I be at ease. May I be happy. So traditionally, you extend this, you know, so it's like working the goodwill muscle, the loving kindness muscle, and then learning to extend it wider and wider to people that you just feel kind of neutral about. And then the most transformative part of this is when you can extend it to somebody with whom you are having difficulty. Because it really counteracts that, you know, the sense of resentment and anger and betrayal and all the kinds of things that we might feel, and sometimes we feel that for ourselves as well. So when we can extend that metta anyway, it really softens and melts that hardness, which is really only hurting ourselves, not the other person. So there's a lot more to metta practice, but I'll move on to investigating. So this is what Shakyamuni Buddha did on the eve of his awakening. So he had done calming meditation and cultivating a positive, clear state of mind. So he said, when the mind was thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilement, pliant, malleable, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of recollecting my past lives. So his question, his koan, was about suffering, about human suffering, and what can we do about it. So in this moment, he looked, you know, and let's just, you know, give it the benefit of the doubt that he had some kind of superpower. He could look over and see his past lives. That's not really so important. But the idea is that he's looking, because the whole Buddhist cosmology was the idea that we're reborn after we die. We're reborn in another existence. And sometimes that existence will be very fortunate and sometimes will be very unfortunate. So he was looking, he looked out and he was able to see all of his past lives, and like, so I was reborn like this, and then this happened, and then that happened, and then that happened. And then he was able to extend and see not just his own life, but the lives of many beings. And he started to see the workings of karma, and he started to see that people, their experience, their fortune, was largely formed by their own actions of body, speech, and mind. That acting in harmful, selfish ways led to suffering. And acting in selfless, wise, liberated, generous ways led to good results. So he really saw this, because, you know, many religious groups at the time thought this was about, you know, the gods up above, or what kind of sacrifices you made to them, or maybe it was just random. There was a lot of theorizing going on at the time about what, you know, led to a good fortune or ill fortune. And so his insight was that it had to do largely with our own conduct. So then he turned his attention, when the mind, he turned, directed it to the knowledge of how do I end mental fermentations? How do I end these, you know, greed, hate, and delusion, and these things that lead people to act in harmful ways? And I discerned, as it was actually present, this is stress or suffering, dukkha. This is how it arises. This is how it ends. This is how I get it to end. So he was examining in his own direct experience, here's the arising of dukkha. What caused that to arise? So in insight meditation, I mean, the mind is employed, but it's in a different way. I think of it as like you're like a scientist who's observing. You're not a scientist who's philosophizing. Like, I think that, you know, probably works like that. You are observing the workings of your own mind. You're observing your own direct experience and seeing what is true. And sometimes this is kind of, you know, dharmic and large, and sometimes this is very personal. Sometimes this is, oh, you know, I notice there's a, you know, great resentment in me toward such and such a person. You know, what is behind that? What is underneath that? I'm thinking that, you know, she doesn't respect me. That's interesting. You know, where did that thought come from? You know, want to think of, maybe is that true? That's just a thought. What if I gave up that thought? Well, that resentment kind of fades. So we can, you know, experiment and observe with our own experience. So, and this is traditionally in Buddhism, mindfulness. There were four cultivations of mindfulness. So there's mindfulness of the body, but that's just the first part. Then there was, the Buddha taught mindfulness of feelings, positive, negative, neutral, really becoming very intimate with your own feelings of positive, negative, neutral. Then mindfulness, close attention to mind states, different kinds of mind states that arise and pass. And then there was mindfulness of dharmas, essentially. Mindfulness of dukkha, mindfulness of the origination of dukkha, mindfulness of all of these teachings, but mindfulness of it in your own direct experience so that you really get transformative insight into how this all works. So, running short on time here, but do a very brief insight meditation. You can become aware of your breathing. You don't have to do anything with your breathing. Just be aware whether your inhalations or exhalations are short or long, without trying to change them, just short inhalation or long inhalation. So if your mind wanders at all, just kind of bring it back to your breathing. Take note of all the places in your body where you feel sensations related to breathing. The coolness in your nose or mouth as the air enters. The warmth as it exits. Sensations of stretching or energy in the chest, abdomen, shoulders, even in your legs. Notice how the whole body breathes. Notice how there's really no boundary. Around your breath or your experience of the breath. Take interest in your breath like you've never noticed it before. Notice how it's an unfolding process. There's in, there's a pause, out, there's a pause. See if you can let go of your sense of I. That there's an eye observing your breathing. See if you can just be the breathing. The breath doesn't require thinking. Always going on. In a sense, your breath is more you than all of your thoughts. So there are many different ways to do this kind of directed insight meditation. A lot of it has to do with just kind of exploring and challenging our sense of I and divisions between mind and body and all that kind of stuff. And like I said, this is typically the kind of meditation done in like Theravadan Buddhism or Vipassana Buddhism. So, you know, there's usually lots of guided meditations out there. There's meditations in the book Radical Acceptance by Tara Brach and others that, you know, where basically you're exploring your internal experience. And then, very briefly, the fourth kind of meditation, the letting go, it's difficult. I mean, it's really, really, really simple and straightforward, and it also is kind of difficult to describe. For Shiken Taza, the just sitting meditation of Soto Zen, it's taking an upright seated posture. So when we say just sitting, that's really what it is. It's just sitting. It's just sitting there. Uchiyama Roshi talks about like putting your bones and your flesh in this position and leaving everything to that. Now, one aspect which I don't know. You know, 20 years from now, I'll probably be a good meditation teacher. I was sitting in Zazen today and I was kind of thinking, you know, how else can I describe this? Because a lot of times when I say you're just sitting there, letting go of doing anything but sitting there, not trying to affect your not trying to control your meditative experience. But that kind of just sounds like you're just like, you know, just sitting there zoning out. But it's not, I realize, you're also paying attention. You're paying attention to everything that happens. When, you know, ideally, that's the intention. So that's the meditative intention that we're coming back to. So you're paying close attention to everything as if this was your last hour alive. Paying close. Now, most of the time we don't manage to summon quite that much energy and enthusiasm, but that is the goal. That's the idea, I guess. Pay close attention. So we're giving up control. We're giving up the effort to make any particular thing happen, and yet we are paying very close attention. So everything is included. Thoughts arise and pass. Emotions arise and pass. Sometimes we're drowsy. Sometimes we're feeling really enthusiastic. Sometimes we're sad, sometimes we're bored, but we're paying attention to everything. And the experience of this is, I feel like it can be all those other kinds of meditation. It can be calming. If you can do deliberately calming meditation as well. But some of us find this actually more calming because there's no effort to try to control the mind. And sometimes the mind is very recalcitrant and doesn't really want to focus on the meditative object. And so kind of letting go like this can actually be more calming. It cultivates certain things. It cultivates to do this, we need to cultivate faith in ourselves, faith in the practice, faith that we can let go of trying to fix everything, understand everything, become someone different, anything. What is this life? Just letting go. It cultivates, I think, a softer sense of self. So in this, I guess this goes into insight a little bit, where when we really, really relinquish our effort to control or even figure out or understand or anything, and we just pay attention and we realize, essentially, we can realize directly the emptiness of self. There is no self in charge the way we think it is. If we really pay attention, we see there's really no boundary between this skin bag and the rest of the world. Our sense of experience is boundless. And this is something that just one of the Tuesday readings we have about Zazen just says, bright clarity appears before you. So it's not a deliberate, directed effort at trying to achieve some insight and explore something, although there's times to do that, but just reality just appears clearly. And I think of it also as a practice of maybe we're cultivating non-duality. We're trying to give up a sense of I versus my meditation experience. Okay, I'm in the present, I wasn't in the present, I was thinking, I'm not thinking, so it's kind of subtle because in some ways it sounds just like that first calming meditation, right? You have an intention, you have a meditative object, which is just sitting, and then you just bring your mind back. But in this, you're trying to skip that I'm bringing my mind back piece. It's just like, you were, you were just sitting all along. I mean, you don't have to do anything. And as soon as you're aware that you were caught up in thoughts, you're not. You didn't make, there's no you that made that happen. It just happened. So it's kind of just a, so I don't have time to lead you through a guided Zen meditation, although I think it might be worth doing that sometimes, because this is a, I think this is an easily misunderstood type of meditation. But I do think if you are incorporating different kinds of meditation into your practice, you know, there's times for all of these different kinds of meditation. Somebody asked me recently, like, if you're sitting there in Zazen and something kind of interesting comes up, like I was saying, like, noticing a, you know, a tough feeling or a, and, you know, then I'll set aside my Zazen and essentially do some insight meditation. I'll essentially do some exploration of that. Here's an opportunity. My mind is still, this thing has appeared before me. What's going on here? But then usually, after exploring it for a little bit, you know, the discursive mind will get in there and I'll realize I'm not really actually making any more progress. Like, I saw a little something and now I'm just thinking about it. Yeah. You know, and then it's time to just, you know, kind of let go again and be still. So, any quick comments or questions before we wrap up? Yeah.
Please, I'm asking for you to tell me whether I'm really off base or whether I have some modicum of understanding when I am in Zazen. When I started to sit, on one level I recognize that there are a myriad of things going on, sights and sounds and smells and feelings and emotions, and I know doggone well that I am not aware of many, many of these myriad things that are going on. And to the degree that I attempt to become aware of what may be present, but maybe has not come up in my awareness, in my consciousness, it becomes simply a jumble, and I do not feel that I am in a meditative state. I am in an effort to try to be aware of all of these things that I find is impossible for me to do. So if I hear a noise outside, whereas the second before I did not hear that noise, then I am aware of it. And then it hopefully goes away. And the same thing may be true of an emotion, a thought, a feeling, or anything else that is there, because there might be a million things going on, and I may be aware of four or five of those million things.
Well, that's where, I mean, if you make,
you know, being aware, you know, paying attention and being aware of everything essentially into a meditative object or goal, like you're saying, I mean, literally it's impossible. It's just not the nature of our awareness. Our attention has, you know, I mean, it can be like this and it can expand a little, but what I think of it is we're just receptive. So we're open to whatever is coming, but then there will be different things will become salient at different times. So it's a very relaxed and natural awareness that I think of, you know, I'm often fond of telling people, I think we knew how to do this when we were little kids. When we were like 2 years old, we could just sit there in the sun and like, whatever, you know, for a while you're looking at a bug and for a while you're just whatever. So there's a natural flow to it that doesn't have a self-consciousness about it. But we, as adults, we get so conscious about it, right? We sit out in the sunshine going, I am being so mindful right now. And, you know, am I a good person? What am I going to do next week? I mean, there's we've added all these layers onto it when actually this is just a very, very natural faculty of awareness. Yeah.
So you call it Zen meditation, but as opposed to insight or vipassana or calming meditation, but a lot of Zen teachers actually teach breath and body meditation. So is this like one kind of Zen meditation instead of just...
Well, I mean, again, like where, you know, how are you going to slice the tomato? Because like, I guess, say, from using my language, I would say Zen teachers will teach all these different kinds of meditation at different times. Maybe not really specifically insight. Like, we don't tend to go into really directed, long, prolonged meditations. But I'm realizing, like, I want people to be doing that anyway. I just thought people would be doing that at other times in their life. So maybe we should spend more time doing it on the cushion. So maybe I'm going to start using more of these other kinds of meditation as well. But I think most Zen teachers would agree those other forms of meditation are not shikantaza. So they would probably just say, you know, they're not shikantaza. And I've heard Zen teachers say, most people are not doing shikantaza. Like, so I think that most of them would parse it out that way. Does that make sense?
I mean, well, the last retreat I was at, Norman was saying that counting your breath, being in your body, is actually the most profound practice. That's so I'm confused. And also in Zen Mountain Monastery, like, it's just like being in Yohara, coming back to it over and over again. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's so tempting as a meditation teacher to say this is the most powerful practice. You know, I totally think shikantaza is the coolest, most powerful practice, but, you know. So I think there's a time and a place when you're in a meditation retreat for somebody to say, do that practice. Mm-hmm. This is the whole, because in a way it's like, it's also like a, I don't know, kind of like a fractal in a way that, like, if you go really, 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 really deeply into one of these kinds of practices, they kind of lead to all the others as well. Just like I'm saying, shikantaza is calming and leads to insight and cultivates things, and yeah, so I mean that whole experience of like following the breath and then being the breath and then no separation between yourself and the breath, and yeah, so that is, you know, in certain Zen settings, that is a very central practice. Yeah.
So insight meditation is really what I've been learning about and studying and practicing now for a while. But I know you're running out of time, but could you just kind of just succinctly just give me a little definition of how what we're doing here is different than that, or what I might see is different than that ultimately?
Well, I guess it's just, I mean, one of the ways that I've parsed this out is a directed effort versus letting go.
So as long as there's a directed effort, like you're sitting down, you're going to meditate, you want to calm the mind, or you want to cultivate metta, or you want to, you know, explore the workings of your mind, or understand impermanence, or, you know, you have some kind of agenda. I think of that as directed effort meditation, which obviously, you know, dates from the beginning of Buddhism and, you know, is employed in many different forms of Buddhism. And I think probably we could benefit from doing it more often. The shikantaza, the letting go, is, I don't know, it's, we let go of any agenda, except we also, which I realize is important to add, we also try to stay and pay attention to everything that's happening. So we don't, I mean, we will check out, but that's our intention is not to check out and to just watch this complete unfolding without trying to monkey with it at all. And I don't know. I mean, it's a frustrating practice in the sense that it's like, okay, so, you know, what did I achieve? Because you don't have an agenda. You're not trying to achieve anything. I guess for me it feels like, for me it feels like a devotional practice. It feels like I devote, you know, 5 days a week, I devote 30 to 50 minutes to the great mystery. And I sit there and try to just be with my life just as it is, in a way that most of the time we're postponing, right? I'll do that once this happens or once that happens or once I fix this, to just be awake and present for everything just as it is.
So isn't it, for me, it's more an acceptance of where I am in that moment in time. And it, you know, if it were to set a goal, which I try not to be so directed like that, but it would be to just create more of an awareness and more of a being of being still and feeling happy and being a good person. And so, and being grateful.
Yeah, and that's what I mean, like, it is, you know, because then you're like, well, then you're kind of cultivating something, right? But I mean, you know, you're letting go, but there's, at the same time, we're kind of cultivating a sense, you know, to really do that, we have to have a sense of kind of trust and gratitude and a willingness to, like, I there was a guy in my online group who, you know, he says he was really grateful for my recent, like, podcast on, it's fine to use multiple kinds of meditation, because he said he always was feeling like vastly inadequate whenever he heard me describe Shikantaza. And because he says, and it's really poignant, he says to do that takes you really have to trust yourself. And that really struck me, and I realized like it's not that there's anything difficult about the practice itself. So it really is accessible to anyone, but I don't know that I trusted myself at the beginning of practice enough to just, you know, be myself, to just be with myself, to... Well, thank you all. Sorry to have kept you a little long.